From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the middle of the desert near the U.S.-Mexico border. A young woman was searching for her brother, who had disappeared while trying to illegally cross from Mexico into the United States. She understood that there was a chance she would find his remains, and she told a film crew that she needed to know where her brother was because in normal circumstances, people don't just leave their families behind. David Wallace is the photojournalist who brought this woman's story to the world through the Arizona Republic. Wallace was part of a team that won a 2018 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for their coverage of the border in a series called The Wall. Wallace filmed and edited the majority of the mini-documentaries that were part of The Wall Project. He's a graduate of RIT, and this week he's joining other RIT alum, colleagues who are talking to students and the Rochester community about a range of issues related to their field. Our guests this week are Pulitzer Prize finalists and winners, and we're thrilled to hear about their work here on Connections. Let me welcome our guests for the hour. The man who's been organizing all of this is the chair of the photojournalism program at RIT and himself a four-time Pulitzer Prize winning photographer, William Snyder. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here again.
Great to have you. Also with us is David Wallace, that 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner we mentioned there. David, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And a 2010 finalist for local reporting, Edmund Fountain. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
William, how's it going this week? I mean, do you feel like there's some energy that students are and maybe the campus and the community are energized by this?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think so. They've had good experiences in classes. I haven't been around for those, but all the feedback I'm getting from the teachers, faculty members say it's going great with the kids. So I'm very excited about that, which is what I'm looking forward to.
And before the hour's out, we'll tell you how you can learn a little bit more about what's happening around the community before the week is up here. You know, when we talked to a couple of your colleagues yesterday, Edmund and David, we talked about not only the work they've done, as we will talk about yours, but also the state of the industry. And I guess I want to start just by asking you if you agree with the sentiments they expressed. Both of your colleagues yesterday said that in no uncertain terms, corporate ownership of newsrooms, of newspapers, generally speaking, has been a disaster for the industry. Edmund, do you agree with that?
I think I do agree with that. I was blessed in that I worked at a large newspaper that was owned by a nonprofit for a long time, and they haven't been doing well either. So I think there's problems that go beyond corporate ownership. And so I don't know that that's the entire...
Sure. It's complex. And is there a more sustainable model that you have sort of seen for the future? Besides, you know, public broadcasting that we're thrilled to. That's the model that we feel good about. But is there a model that you see that you like?
I think there's pluses and minuses to all the different models, but I think all of them are imperfect.
Okay.
I'll jump in. I mean, I think that to support local journalism, a model that could work is a sort of subscription-based model. I think for too long there was just too much content that was out there that people could get for free. So one of the things that we're trying to do in my news organization is just getting people to subscribe. If they value the content that we cover for a local community, a subscriber sort of based system, it's really paying huge for the New York Times, and where that's sort of the direction that we're really trying to go after.
The concern I have is that so much content has been free for so long that we've created a generation of news consumers who expect everything to be free.
And yeah. I think that's worked really well for publications like the New York Times and, say, the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, large media outlets. But I think on a regional, more local level, people have been extremely conditioned to expect that they can get that material, that content for free. And so I think trying to kind of rewire the community's brain to understand that, oh, they need to pay for this too because this also costs money, I think that's a much more difficult thing to do.
Yeah, and I think you really have to set yourself apart in the content that you're putting out there, if you want people to sort of pay for it. And that was one of the things that, you know, we did with the Wall Project. I mean, we just dove, you know, 9 months of reporting, not just stories and photos, but mini documentary videos, virtual reality, podcasts, and really showing our community that, you know, if you want this kind of journalism, it does need to be supported.
That's one of the themes that I want to talk to both of our guests today about, which is the commitment to the necessary time to tell stories, especially for stories that are investigative in nature, that, you know, that, well, these days there's so much content to feed. There's websites. I mean, deadlines are very different than they were even when I was in school. So I want to talk a little bit later in the hour in the value in that and the concern, at least that I have in some ways, that that gets a little more compromised when there's so much demand and the staffs are smaller. But just on the subject of you know, sort of putting the toothpaste back in the tube, so to speak, I don't know how we do that. How do you retrain a generation of people to say, hey, you're going to have to pay for news, other than maybe a continued public dialogue about the value of it, sort of a re-education of the public that journalism itself has been injured here by this notion that it is always going to be free. And Edmund's point's an interesting one. I hadn't thought about it this way, but locally and regionally, more pain felt because when margins are small, yeah, if your volume is huge, look at the New York Times or the Washington Post, you can withstand that. Less so when you're smaller.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. I live in New Orleans now, and I think it was in 2012, the newspaper there, the Times-Picayune, stopped publishing every day. And people were up in arms. They were angry. They felt like they'd lost a watchdog in their community. And what happened is the newspaper in Baton Rouge saw an opportunity and opened up a bureau in New Orleans and staffed it and started putting out a daily edition. And that, I think, is now equal to, maybe it's surpassed the Times-Picayune, but it's kind of the paper of record in New Orleans now, and they're about to go behind a paywall because they've had so much success.
Are you concerned about what happens to them when they put the paywall up?
I am. But I'm also, you know, I'm equally interested to see if it works, and I hope it does.
We had a recent series that just ran actually just last week on Sandra Day O'Connor, and it was a series of stories and videos, and for the first 5 days, that content was only available to subscribers. You could see a, sort of like a landing page. Anyone could see the landing page, and there was a sort of a button on there that said, you know, if this is something that interests you, consider subscribing, and somebody could then click on that button and subscribe. And through those 5 days, I mean, it wasn't a huge number of subscribers that we gained, but it was, you know, it was a good number, and it was directly from that content, the way that was set up. And then after the 5 days, it was available to anyone. So,
Do you both expect to be able to work in this field if you want to for the rest of your careers? That's a wry smile, David.
I think I will evolve. So yes, I do. Maybe not exactly how I am right now, but I've only been working in newspapers my entire career, but my job during my almost 18 years doing this has evolved. It's totally different. What I do now is totally different than what I did 10 years ago. So whether or not my job will be exactly what it looks like right now, I don't know if I could answer you that, but I know I'll be telling stories.
Okay.
Yeah.
Edmund?
Yeah. I work as a freelance photographer now. I left the Times in 2014, the St. Petersburg Times. And I think I could, if I wanted to, I could be a photographer for the rest of my career. I don't know that I would necessarily work in journalism for the rest of my career.
By choice or necessity?
I think by necessity. I mean, I work outside of journalism already as it is, just because I need to.
Okay. And David, just can you paint a little picture for our listeners? 10 years ago versus today, you say your job is very different. So 10 years ago, an average day or an average week would entail what compared to now?
10 years ago, I would, my day would typically entail 2 to 3 assignments, and 90% of the content that I was producing from those assignments was still photographs, a little bit of video. That has evolved today where I don't take on any daily assignments. My focus is just long-term projects and, with, a focus of producing documentary video content. I still do shoot some stills, but that's a very small part of my job now. I'm also working with other people in our newsroom to help them develop concepts of how can we use video as a storytelling method. So, yeah, my job today doesn't look anything like what it did when I started at the Arizona Republic.
Okay. And do you both feel, I mean, for lack of a better term, comfortable with the evolution of the need for the different sort of skill sets? Is it at least sort of in the same universe for you? Because, as you say, it's different than 10 years ago. But
still storytelling.
It's still storytelling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I love it. It's been a total blessing. I mean, all these twists and turns in different directions I've gone in, I never would have anticipated it, but I wouldn't want it any other way.
Okay. Edmund?
The shifts in technology, I think, over the last 15 years or so, it's really increased the number of ways that you can put content out there and tell stories. And I think that's, in some ways, made content accessible to a larger number of people, and that's great because you want as many people as possible to consume what you're doing and be informed.
Well, listeners, as we go throughout the hour here, I think that's it's an outstanding opportunity to hear from award-winning photojournalists about the work that they have done, the future of the industry. I'm wondering, you know, how many people who hear the sound of my voice now pay for a newspaper subscription anymore? I hope it's a lot.
Subscribe, please.
I say it all the time, and they're technically competitors. But as a journalist, I want very much to see, I think local print is vital as a watchdog. And I've worked in commercial television news, which does a little bit of that, but not anything like what you see in print, generally speaking. And so I'm deeply concerned. And I always say, hey, I hope you're a member of WXXI, and I hope you have a subscription in the newspaper. Sort of a statement of values in many ways. So I already see the phone ringing. People are going to tell us yes or no. But you can email the program this hour, connections@wxxi.org. Part of what we want to do is spend the hour talking about the work that has been done that not only led to the Pulitzer Committee noticing the work, but also is making such an impact. And so let me start with David Wallace in this regard, a 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner for explanatory reporting. The Wall is a series, as you said, sort of multimedia, a lot of different ways of telling the story there. But how did it come together? I mean, clearly, this wasn't the first time you're covering immigration. It's not the first time you're covering border issues, you know, working for the Arizona Republic. But you want to kind of package it in a certain way. Whose idea was it? What were those conversations like?
Yeah. It's an interesting story behind that. So it was October of 2016, so about a month before the presidential election, and Republican candidate Donald Trump was holding a rally in Prescott, Arizona, which is a little ways outside Phoenix. And our then executive editor, Nicole Carroll, decided to go with the reporters and photographers that were covering the rally to just get a firsthand account. And during the rally, as in many other Trump rallies, people started chanting, build the wall, build the wall, build the wall. So Nicole thought, well, what would that really mean? I mean, it can't just be as simple as a sort of three-word slogan. So she came up with the idea of doing this really in-depth explanatory look at what the border is and what would the unintended consequences be if a wall was actually built, and really looking at, is it even possible to build a wall? So the hook of the project was to actually fly via helicopter and film. It's just shy of 2,000 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, the entire border. So that was done by a reporting team. It took, I think, 8 or 9 days, and they filmed every single inch of the border from the air. And then we also had reporting teams on the ground working on these documentary stories and projects, and that was how I got involved in the project.
When this project launched here, did you know how many documentaries? Did you know how many stories? Did you know roughly how long you wanted to be working on this?
I think the original plan was 12. We ended up doing 15. Mm-hmm. So it did expand a little bit. There was months of planning and pre-reporting going into it. I didn't know of those initial 12 how many I was going to be working on. My involvement in the project kind of expanded as it was going on. I don't think the initial plan was for me to do the video editing, and then I got largely involved in that. But Yeah, I mean, it was both a lot of planning ahead of time, but we were also fluid, and it evolved as we were working on it.
Now, so much of the work from the wall helps readers, helps viewers and listeners to the podcast and all the different platforms you used. It helps them understand what's at stake when we talk, when you take a short phrase that became one of the emblems of a presidential campaign, and frankly, one of the emblems of sort of the id of this presidency, and you start actually asking, in practice, what does it mean? So what I don't want to do is ask you to summarize in any way that sort of denigrates the complexity, because I think that's so much of what I value in journalism as a journalist and as a consumer is understanding complexity. But do you feel like you, at the end, you achieved helping people understand really what's at stake here if we're going to get serious about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, did we cover every facet of the border? I mean, certainly not. I mean, I'm sure there's probably another 15 stories that could have been equally compelling that we didn't cover. But I think we really did take a very holistic look at the border, how it affects economics, people, security, communities, and then also this sort of survey we did by filming the entire border. What does it look like physically? And, you know, you can look, you can go onto our site, thewall.usatoday.com, and you could look at any of all of that aerial video is available to look at.
What kind of response and feedback did you get?
I mean, just lots and lots of comments. We were looking at the metrics of how many people were viewing the stories and the videos and also how long they were engaging with it. And then when we won the Pulitzer Award, you know, that was another opportunity to sort of put that content back out there and get people excited about it again. So
what was the, this is something that, unless you've worked in journalism, deadlines are sort of abstract to your readers. They only see it when it gets done. Sometimes there's pressure. You've got maybe an amazing piece of tape or amazing images, an amazing story. And that's a word that I don't use very often, but something that's really powerful, something that's really compelling. And sometimes you have editors, and certainly in commercial television news, you've got producers who I love, who might be like, well, hey, you know, could we maybe get that on tomorrow? How's that turning around? Did you feel any heat to kind of turn things, or did you feel like we've got the space we need? How did that process work?
Yeah, I mean, I got all the time that I needed.
Wow.
I mean, I started working on the project in early April of 2017, and that was all I did until October of 2017. No daily assignments, no other work. That is, it was a first for me in my career, and it's just very unusual in the newspaper world. Now, that having said that, I mean, I did have deadlines because it was such a huge team effort that there were, you know, web developers that needed to get content. So I was definitely burning the candle from both ends. But it wasn't like, okay, we need this next, you know, week when we're just starting it. I mean, they really gave us the time and resources to do the reporting.
What I appreciate as a reader is the way that you have and your organization has collected the wall and presented it. So listeners, if you want to check it out, there's a lot there, and we'll make sure we post it on our various platforms. So again, so we don't over-summarize here. But one of the questions you said you wanted to answer is, could you even really do it? Is it realistically possible? Is there a short answer to that? Can we build that wall?
In places, definitely. And I think in places, definitely not. I mean, there's this one place called Big Bend National Park, and it's this canyon that is probably over 1,000 feet deep and maybe a quarter mile wide. And I mean, that you don't need more of a wall than that. I mean, to cross, I mean, that's an impenetrable fortress, but I don't think you could build a wall there. I mean, there's other places in southern Arizona, these incredibly rugged, remote mountains. And if you were to build a wall in those places, you'd first have to build roads out, you know, 40, 50 miles into these really remote areas through the mountains. I mean, I guess, is it possible? I mean, we've done incredible engineering feats, so maybe it's possible, but is it cost effective? I mean, that's another question.
I want to listen to a clip, if we could, of audio of the woman that I mentioned at the outset of the program who you met in the middle of the desert searching for her brother. And this is from one of the many documentaries that David and the team produced for the Arizona Republic series, The Wall. Let's listen to her in this clip talking about what she was trying to do.
we're in the middle of the desert. Where we're walking to is where my brother was walking through when they said he got left behind. I'm trying to see if it's my brother. If it's my brother, we're trying to take him home. Cremate him, make him an altar at the house. Hopefully it's not him though. Need to know where my brother's at. You don't just leave family behind.
Right now, having a missing person on the border, you could wait years before finding out what really happened. Some folks might never find out. Without having those answers, I think people are really kind of frozen in time. They don't know if their missing loved one is alive or dead. It's like living in a nightmare that never ends until you get the answers that you need.
How many stories like that did you hear?
That was probably the most powerful one. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there were many, many compelling stories and unexpected stories. You know, people that live on the border that are Trump supporters and conservative, but weren't necessarily in favor of the wall.
Why is that?
Just because I think that that's where they live and they didn't want a 30-foot wall in their backyard. And I think they also didn't think it would be very effective.
Interesting. And in this case, what the woman looking for her brother here, as the narration mentioned here, it could be years, and you know you're meeting people who are desperate there. It's always a sensitive job. How do you approach having those kinds of conversations with people, knowing that they're literally in the desert looking for a loved one who may already be dead?
So in that particular case, it was myself, a writer and a still photographer. And, you know, I think we were with her all day. We were probably out there 6 hours or something like that looking. And it was, you know, talking to her when it seemed like she wanted to talk. It was giving her space when it seemed like she needed space, which was also good, too, for the photography and for the filming to give her that space. And, you know, also asking her questions that were not just about us getting content we wanted, but just being a person. Hey, how are you doing? Are you too hot? You know, stuff like that. Do you want to stop and have water? I mean, I think she actually, I think she, in a way, appreciated that we were out there and that we were interested in telling her story. And I mean, maybe she also felt more comfortable that, you know, she was doing this pretty crazy, dangerous thing, and she had three people sort of joining her on that journey.
Do you know what happened?
I do, yeah. And actually, that it if you watch the full documentary, it's a 12-minute documentary, you'll see what happens. We did not find Carlos's remains on that day, but eventually they were found.
Talking to David Wallace, the 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner for explanatory reporting for his work near the border. So now that you're seeing this national conversation about immigration, about whether it's building a wall, immigration numbers, border issues and security, are there any routine comments, questions, ideas that you hear that you feel like, boy, that is not how it is? I mean, do you feel, generally speaking, having spent so much time there, that people get wrong?
I don't know if people get it wrong. I just think that it's just not a simple. I mean, I think that, you know, the vast majority of the country does not live anywhere near the border with Mexico. So their understanding of it are these, you know, phrases, or there are short sound bites on television news, or there are even, you know, short stories in print or on websites. And I just think they have a really oversimplified understanding of what it is. It's complex. I mean, there is definitely an issue of people crossing the border illegally. There are, you know, the human smuggling issue is we explored that too in the report. I mean, it's an issue. There is drugs coming over the border, But it's very, very complex. And I think that we tried to sort of break down those complexities in the project.
Did you have times where when you're working, is essentially day trips? Were you out there for a while in some more extreme places?
Yeah, we didn't really do any day trips. Yeah. We would go out for like, so it wasn't like we were out down there for four straight months. You know, we would go down for 5 or 6 days and work on something and then come back for 3 or 4 days and go back down. But I mean, we were spending a lot of time there, and it wasn't just me too. I mean, there was probably over a dozen people that were sort of working kind of the way that I was working with my team.
You're not averse to some extreme conditions though. You've done the PCT.
Yeah.
So right after you graduated from RIT, you did what, 2,600 miles?
Yeah, about that.
Mexico border to Canada. So listeners, if you don't know about this, the Pacific Crest Trail.
Yeah.
You start on the U.S.-Mexico border and you end up at the Canada border?
Correct.
And it took you how many months?
4.5 months.
Probably some snow in the mountains at times?
Yeah, it was a dry winter, so we didn't have a ton of snow, but there was definitely snow up in the Sierras in California, yeah.
Could you even have imagined that you're starting on the U.S.-Mexico border and that years later you're going to win a Pulitzer for reporting on the border?
No.
Is there some strange symmetry there?
No, yeah, maybe. And what's cool is in the reporting, we actually went, our reporting didn't take us right to where the Pacific Crest Trail starts, but we were in the area, so I made a quick side trip to check it out, and it was, it was very interesting.
Did the PCT help you for kind of dealing with extreme conditions?
For sure. I mean, I think all experiences in life sort of help you. I mean, definitely.
Before our only break, and we're going to hear Edmund Fountain's story on what made him a 2010 finalist for local reporting in just a moment. Anything you're working on now that you can tell us about that is that sort of fires you up, or that you at least have some time to work on?
Yeah, I'm working. I'm doing an ongoing project on child welfare, and we're going to be producing a longer documentary for that. Which has really been a challenging project, but as a parent myself, it's something that I find incredibly important and rewarding to work on. I'm doing a smaller piece about a Korean War veteran, but it also kind of takes a look at his life in Arizona, deals with segregation and racism, and it's a fascinating story that I'm working on right now.
I want to ask William Snyder, who's a four-time Pulitzer Prize winner and has worked at a number of different publications, about the question of deadlines. And it's really, to me, it gives me a lot of optimism to hear the stories that our guests are telling today about the time that they had to tell stories, the time to investigate. I work for an organization now that when there is a story that needs time, we don't have anybody telling you, well, we need that tomorrow, we'd love it next week. I mean, they say, when do you think? But let's talk about it. Let's make sure we've got time to be thorough, to be right. And I think sometimes we think of that as sort of this anachronistic idea about American journalism. It's not necessarily totally, but it's really valuable, isn't it?
Oh, time other than trust are the most important assets things that we deal with in the business. I worked at a very large newspaper for a long, long time in very different capacities. And we were blessed that when we had things that warranted it, we were allowed the right amount of time. But, you know, we've had conversations about this amongst ourselves, that there's always this notion of, whether it was writers or photographers, sort of holding things back because we don't want, in our world, editors to know about them too early because they'll do the exact same thing. Well, we've got a big hole. Do you think?
And that's only natural. I get it.
Yes, and being on all sides of that, I get that too. And that's where it's important. Again, we were having a conversation about this the other day. It's important that as photographers and photojournalists. That we actually act like journalists and not just photographers, and we're out there developing stories and developing interesting scenarios to make photographs of and tell stories about, so that there's always something that we can offer that we sort of have put away. when I ran a bureau and then ultimately when I ran the paper, I always told everybody, look, you have a choice. You can take a piece of paper and do what somebody else has probably not thought through very well visually, or you can go out and you can find something and we'll push that instead. Mm-hmm. And I was blessed, all the staff that I worked with, that's what they wanted to do. They didn't want to take a piece of paper. And so, you know, time is important. And, you know, they talk about, well, there's a deadline every minute now because of the web. Well, I think it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about news, I think it's still important to get it right before you get it first. There, you know, we've seen way too many times that organizations in a rush to get first don't get it correct, don't get it right. And that, I think we're finally seeing that change a little bit, which is really, really important.
Let me also give a little bit of love to editors and producers, because I'm a little bit maligning them too much here. Because they're not always the types who just want something to fill. There are times where their voice wisely tells us, hey, you got this. And the example that comes to mind is, you know, it was a couple of years ago, there was a team of people, but really producer Megan Mack and I worked for the better part of a year on a story about how if everybody knows, it's no secret that when you grow up and you go to school, you rarely have teachers of color. But the number of, for example, African-American teachers in Rochester suburban districts, it was shockingly low. There were four districts with zero black teachers in the entire district out of hundreds, four other districts with one African-American teacher in the entire school district. So thousands of school children are going to school and graduating and never seeing a black teacher, maybe never seeing a teacher of color at all. But then you start going, well, but what's quote-unquote average? You know, what's happening in Syracuse and Buffalo and Cleveland and nationally? And then you can start to paralyze yourself after a year's work and you go, but I can contextualize this even further. And eventually you've got editors who go, hey, you've done the work now, and we're going to put this together.
Exactly.
And that's, so a little love for editors and producers.
We're not
all maligning.
No. The best editors, you know, that's what they do. I mean, and if you're in a print publication, you've literally got space you have to fill at times. And I get that. But you asked a question yesterday of, I think it was Paula, you know, when do we know when a story is done?
Yeah.
You know, some of the best of us, given our druthers, we're going to keep going and going and going and going and going. And it's important that there's somebody there, because I've been on both sides. I've been the photographer and I've been the editor, to be able to say to somebody, okay, look, we're at a really good place now.
We can publish. Especially a great example is at the border.
Yeah.
The series The Wall.
Yeah.
What is enough to feel like you can publish? You could report on that every day, every week, every month, and never stop.
Yeah.
Let's get our only break, and we're going to come back and talk to Edmund about his work. And the best way I can describe it is vital, but pretty disturbing in terms of the Pulitzer finalist work. And so we're going to talk about that with Edmund Fountain, a Pulitzer finalist himself. David Wallace is here. William Snyder from RIT, talking about photojournalism, journalism, the future of the industry, and more coming up here. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about what gentrification is, how it's defined, the history of gentrification, and what communities can do if they are concerned about it happening. Now, the big buzz phrase in development these days is development without displacement. But how do you achieve that? And where in Rochester can we focus the efforts? That's next hour on Connections. This is Connections on WXXI. William Snyder from RIT. What is happening that you want people to know about? Not because these photojournalists are not just talking to students, but what's happening?
No, we're trying to get them in front of the public. And you know, just like this show, the idea is to have folks understand what it is that we do and how we do it. More importantly, how we do it, and then also why we do it. So tonight, there's a public program at the RIT City Art Space, which is at Sibley Square. It's in Sibley Square at 280 East Main Street at the Liberty Pole. It will start at 5:30 and it'll go to about 7 or thereabouts. And we'll have David Wallace, David Carson, Edmund Fountain, and Paula Bronstein, and they're going to show and talk about their work. So for those of you out there, please come by tonight and see this work that we've been talking about and ask questions. we probably won't have enough time today to answer all your questions on this show, so come by tonight, and we'd love to have you.
Let me squeeze in an email from Dave, who writes to us to say, Evan, I subscribe to the DNC and another local publication. I've always subscribed to my local paper. I'm happy to do so. Local papers need to do better work. They're shrinking the content while ramping up the cost. Gannett has been at the forefront of this. Digital First sounds like it would or will be worse. Content is not and has never been free. We've always paid with our eyes the viewing of ads. If I'm paying for it, it should come ad-free. Otherwise, why bother? I'm also tired of being nickeled and dimed. If I subscribe to my local paper, I ought to, I don't know, get a pass for others, especially if they are part of the same Gannett family. But even if not, I can't afford to subscribe to every paper in the country. That goes sort of true at the national level, too. Should I really have to pay $10 a month to the New York Times, Washington Post, The Journal, so many more? Where do I draw the line? This all adds up to the most interesting thing that has happened recently, WXXI buying City News. That's our alt-weekly here. That's the future of journalism, Dave says. Publicly supported, hyperlocal, all funds going to journalism, not to profit from a far-off conglomerate. Thank you. Dave, thanks. And that idea that, hey, if I'm going to subscribe to the Picayune or the Arizona Republic or the Cleveland Plain Dealer or whatever, should that get me a pass in to see content from other places? Do you guys agree with that?
I mean, different newspapers or different companies. I mean, his point initially that that he's a subscriber to the DNC, should he have a pass to other Gannett?
Yeah,
I mean, that's maybe a point. But if they're different companies, I don't know how that would work as far as a business model. So
okay,
I mean, if you buy your groceries at Wegmans, it doesn't mean you could get to go into a Publix and get stuff for free. It's a different company.
And Dave, I suspect, though I don't want to speak for the decision makers in various organizations, that that's why you get, for example, maybe 3 free articles a month. Because if you're in Rochester but you want to read some things that are going on that the Arizona Republic has done, but you don't live there, maybe 3 free articles a month makes sense.
Well, we give 25 free articles per month.
Oh.
And then on top of that, our premium
I don't want to tell your business office how to do their job. I'd do less, but go ahead.
Our pieces of premium content, such as The Wall, they didn't have any ads on them at all. So anyhow, and that was a very, very expensive project.
Yeah,
Well, I also think that the public, Dave, I think you said,
yeah.
You know, you need to understand that this costs a lot of money to produce. You know, the subject we were talking about right before the break, time. Time is money. You know, David Wallace and I were talking about this the other day, and I think you said you figured the project cost somewhere around $1 million.
Yeah, I don't know the exact figures, but it was a lot of money.
I mean, think about that. That's $1 million, and it's done a great service not only to the Arizona Republic readers, but the country in general. You know, that's a lot of money, and I understand the reader's frustration. But you also have to understand that these things do cost money. You don't want to see ads. Well, you know, the thing is, what everybody doesn't understand is that it used to be, before the internet came, it was the ads that really paid for the paper. The subscriptions were only, for most papers, subscriptions were only about 20-25% of the revenue. The rest of it was the ads. And when the ads moved online and basically went free, you know, that was a huge chunk out of the revenue. And so you've got to understand, I brought this up yesterday. You know, Facebook now is complaining because their model is not working as well as they want it to anymore because there's a dearth of local news. Well, I wonder why. You know, yes, you know, as Edmund says, it's a very complex thing. Yes, I hold corporations responsible for some of this. But as Edmund said, he worked for a nonprofit and they still ran into problems. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a way to figure out the economic model. I think that it's doable. It just has to be a totally different way of thinking about things.
I want to ask Edmund Fountain about the series that landed him as a 2010 Pulitzer finalist, and it is. I'd like you to tell the story as much as possible because I have no expertise, and I find it harrowing and difficult to even talk about, and I don't want to mistake any of the details. So take us back.
Okay, so I was a finalist for a series of stories that was titled "For Their Own Good," and it explored a century of abuse at a state-run reform school in Florida, And what happened was we ran a, we published a little brief, just 2-3 sentences that mentioned that a plaque had been hung at this school in the, it was in the town of Marianna, Florida, about an hour and a half west of Tallahassee. And this plaque sort of acknowledged that kids had been abused there years ago. And when we published that brief, we had a bunch of people come into our newsroom and say that they were all kept there as kids and that they were abused. And they all told the same story about how it happened, but they didn't know each other. And I ran into a writer, and he was like, yeah, that there has to be so many more of them. And, you know, I photographed a couple of them, and we were going to do a daily story. A different writer was going to do a daily story, and that got put on hold once the thought was sort of planted that there's more of these people out there. And this was in, I think, October of 2008. And so for the next few months, these two writers and myself set off trying to find all these kids, or all these now older men who had been beaten there. And it ultimately, it printed in, I think, April of 2009 as its own sort of 6-page standalone section in the paper. And then that, you know, there's this saying in journalism that if you shake a tree, fruit will fall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we shook the tree and found more people that were kept there later. And ultimately, we found juveniles that were just out and talked to them, too. And the methods of abuse had changed, but it was still happening. And ultimately, a couple of years later, the school ended up shutting down, and then they exhumed all these unmarked graves on the campus. I mean, this came after we were named as Pulitzer finalists, but
they're literally exhuming graves at that point.
Yeah, there was a cemetery on the campus that had all these white crosses, and a forensic anthropologist got wind of our reporting and became interested in figuring out who was down there, because a lot of these men that had been abused were, you know, telling us stories of friends getting murdered, friends getting chased down by dogs, shot at with shotguns by guards when they tried to escape this place. And so she decided she wanted to figure out what happened and got permission, and ultimately found many more bodies than there were markers, and in some cases was able to get the remains back to their families. And so, you know, the being a Pulitzer finalist was cool, but being able to help shut down a place where kids were getting tortured was, I think, cooler.
And some have described this as a facility where people went in damaged and left, if they left at all, destroyed.
Ben Montgomery wrote that, the writer that I worked with.
Yep.
And that's true. A lot of these men spent the rest of their lives, you know, having to go to anger management school, beating their kids, suffering from drug problems, drinking problems. There was a point where we found we snuck into some of the abandoned buildings on this campus, which when we started reporting on it, there was a part of it that had been derelict for a bit. But it wasn't fenced off. It wasn't marked with no trespassing signs. So we were like, oh, we're going to go in there. We found a roster of kids that was there in 1988, just dumped in a toilet. And so we took it and contacted every single person, and we found that, you know, 97-98% of them were still in the correction system in Florida as adults. And this one guy that we met, Aaron Burns, we linked up with him when he was in a halfway house, and, you know, seemingly kind of on the straight and narrow, but, you know, sometime after we wrote about him, we started getting calls from him at like 2-3 in the morning, just like blind drunk, just,
oh.
Yeah. And so these guys ended up with a whole host of problems that they shouldn't have they shouldn't have had to deal with given their situations. I think when they went in there, a lot of these men were just sent there for skipping school or for you know, running away because they were being abused at home, and then they came out hardened criminals.
Yeah, so just a couple of observations. First, there's the obvious parallel to the Catholic priest abuse scandal, where you report on, you know, a number of cases, and then all of a sudden so many others come forward as you experience sort of the shaking the tree analogy. But also, you know, in a sense, this is about one facility and it's just ugly, awful history. But it's also a way for us to see when we decide that when someone is incarcerated or even trying to be rehabilitated, that hard line of punitive punishment, of whatever, you know, sort of dark approach is, it can break people. And then the spiral effect, it's the domino effect, you know, the recidivism that they have. Or you say that, you know, 97, 98% were incarcerated themselves, but also the people they might have abused, the children they might have abused. And then if we bump into someone later in life and we don't know anything about their past, they go, well, that guy beats his kids, he's a terrible person. Well, I'm not saying that's not terrible, but I think the kind of reporting that you and the team did help illustrate how complex and how deep that goes. So it wasn't just about one facility, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, this was about one facility.
No, but for me, it's about society. It's about how we treat people and what happens when people are abused, are tortured, and what they end up doing.
Yeah, and in the case of a lot of these men, they had been kind of quietly harping on it for years. They would tell, you know, their wife or their kids, hey, this happened to me. And they couldn't believe it because it was too far. The behavior was so cruel.
Yeah.
And once all these other men started coming forward and saying, hey, this happened to me too, and it was as if a huge weight had gotten lifted off of these guys' shoulders, because finally people believe them, and there was Ben and Waveney and myself listening to them. And they, I think, in a weird way, us reporting so heavily on them gave them a sense of a little bit of closure that they'd never had. I honestly don't think there's ever going to be complete closure for them. Ben and I have talked about this at length, and we don't know what that looks like.
Yeah. Before we lose the hour, I want to ask you just a little bit about your thoughts on the notion of deadlines, the time investment here. I mean, this is a project that took a long time as well here, and we've been talking a lot about those issues.
It did. When I was working on this, this town was, I think, 4 or 5 hours away from Tampa Bay, where I lived at the time. And we'd go up there for a few days and report, photograph. And as we got deeper into it, I asked for and was typically granted more and more time and autonomy to go photograph these men. I started going to reunions that they'd have, and I'd just be off the books working on this project. I'd still have to come back and photograph other things. And then when it finally we got like 6 weeks away from publication, I was sort of taken off the books completely because I was also working with a video component and I needed to edit that. And there was a lot of late nights, a lot of really early mornings. But I think I was given the time I needed. And then after we published that first story and got so many more subsequent stories from it, I was really, I think, given all the time I needed. And I was blessed with that.
Let me ask you if you would tell students, and if you're telling RIT students, rethink your career. Too volatile. The industry has changed too much. Or are you saying you're going to make it work? It's important.
Oh, I love what I do. And I think if I wanted, you know, I didn't become a photographer or a photojournalist to become a millionaire. I chose this profession because I love what I do. And I think if you go in with the mindset that you want to tell stories and you're genuinely curious about people, you can make it work and you'll find ways to make it work.
What do you tell them, David?
Yeah, I agree with everything Edmund just said. Curiosity about people and the world, but be open to changing. I mean, what you start at You know what your sort of core beliefs are of what you want to do, but there's more than one way to do that. So I think if you're able to evolve and you love it and you have a passion and you work hard and a little bit of talent, I think you can make a go of it.
Also, subscribe to newspapers.
Please.
I want to thank Edmund and David for sharing their stories. And you know, we talked about what ended up getting the notice of the Pulitzer committees, but that's just a small section of the work that they have done over the years. Thank you for what you're doing and for the insight and the expertise this hour. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
And our thanks to William Snyder. I hope you are greatly enjoying yourself this week.
Oh, yeah. How could I not?
Well, I know. You know, you've got an RIT alum and really distinguished alum here talking to students with events around the community. We always appreciate the conversation, so let's talk again soon.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
William Snyder is a 4-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, chair of the photojournalism program at RIT. And the alums this hour, David Wallace, Edmund Fountain here. Our thanks to them as well. Short break, more connections coming up.